A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a layered question. He's been thinking about those expired Israeli gas masks we all have sitting in our closets, the ones distributed during the Syrian chemical weapons scare. That got him wondering about CBRN masks, the kind preppers reach for when they're thinking about worst-case scenarios, nuclear war with Iran. And here's the twist. He assumed CBRN covered chemical weapons too, but apparently that's not quite how the categories work. So his real question is, are conventional chemical weapons and the nuclear radiological threat separate categories requiring different protection? And then he zooms out, forget the Mars question for a minute. We talk endlessly about preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons. What about the non-proliferation of chemical weapons? How many states actually have them, use them, and what treaties exist to stop them?
This is exactly the kind of question where the popular understanding and the technical reality have drifted apart in a way that actually matters. And the confusion starts with that term, CBRN. Chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear. It's this tidy four-letter acronym that suggests one category, one kind of threat, one kind of protection. But the acronym is a bureaucratic invention, not a scientific one.
The alphabet strikes again.
So let me break this down concretely. A CBRN mask, the kind you'd buy from a preparedness supplier, is designed for what's called a multi-threat environment. It's filtering particulates. It's handling certain vapors. It's got a broad spectrum approach. And yes, it will protect against many chemical agents. But here's where it gets specific. The masks Israel distributed to civilians in the early 90s and again in the early 2000s were not CBRN masks in the full sense. They were chemical warfare protective masks, optimized for nerve agents and blister agents, specifically the one Syria was known to possess, sarin, VX, sulfur mustard.
The Israeli mask was a specialist, not a generalist.
Think of it this way. A CBRN mask is like a Swiss Army knife. The Israeli-issued mask was like a specialized lockpick. If your known threat is your neighbor having a very specific arsenal of nerve agents, you don't need the broadest possible protection. You need the best possible protection against organophosphates. And in some cases, optimizing for that means trading off against other threats. The filtration media, the seal design, the materials, they're all tuned.
Which means the guy who bought a $300 CBRN mask on some prepper site might actually have less protection against sarin than the expired Israeli mask sitting in my closet that I can't legally throw away.
That's the uncomfortable truth, yeah. And the expiration date thing is its own rabbit hole. The Israeli masks were issued with a shelf life, but the actual degradation depends on storage conditions, the specific materials, whether the seal was ever broken. There are masks from the 1990s that would still perform adequately, and there are masks from 2010 that are completely compromised because they sat in a hot car for 2 summers. The expiration date is partly chemistry and partly liability.
The legal department's favorite kind of science.
Let me pull back to the bigger question, because this is where it gets genuinely interesting. The prompt is asking, essentially, why do we have this elaborate global architecture for nuclear non-proliferation and a much patchier, less effective one for chemical weapons? And the answer is, we actually do have a chemical weapons treaty, and it's one of the most successful arms control agreements in history. But it's also got a huge enforcement problem.
Walk me through it. What's the treaty?
The Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, entered into force in 1997. It's administered by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, based in The Hague. And unlike the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which essentially created a two-tier system of haves and have-nots, the CWC is egalitarian. Every state party agrees to destroy all chemical weapons, never develop or acquire new ones, and submit to inspections.
It's a total ban, not a managed club.
No one gets to keep a chemical deterrent. And the numbers are impressive. 193 states have joined. That's near universal. The OPCW has overseen the destruction of over 98% of the world's declared chemical weapons stockpiles. We're talking about 72,000 metric tons of chemical agents destroyed under verification. The United States finished destroying its last chemical weapons in 2023. Russia completed its declared destruction, though there are questions about undeclared stocks.
That's actually... for a global treaty regime, I mean.
The OPCW even won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2013. But here's where it gets dark. The treaty has teeth on paper. The problem is, what happens when a state party decides to ignore it, or when a non-party state uses chemical weapons with impunity? Syria is the textbook case. Syria was not a party to the CWC until 2013, and it only joined under duress after the Ghouta sarin attack that killed over 1,400 people. That attack was the enforcement trigger. The US and Russia brokered a deal, Syria joined the CWC, declared its stockpile, and the OPCW oversaw destruction. Except we now know, from OPCW investigation reports and UN mechanisms, that Syria's declaration was fraudulent. They hid stocks, they continue producing, and they use chemical weapons repeatedly after joining. Chlorine, sarin, sulfur mustard. The OPCW's investigation and identification team has attributed multiple attacks to the Syrian Arab Air Force.
Syria joined the treaty, lied about what they had, kept using the weapons, and the treaty mechanism couldn't stop them.
Couldn't stop them because the enforcement mechanism depends on the UN Security Council. And Russia has vetoed every meaningful consequence. Syria has been suspended from certain OPCW rights, including voting rights, which is almost unprecedented. But suspension doesn't destroy the weapons. It doesn't protect civilians in Douma or Khan Shaykhun.
That's the Maginot Line problem again. A perfect defensive structure that the threat simply routes around.
It connects directly to the gas mask question from the earlier episode. Israel invested in civil defense masks precisely because the treaty regime, however impressive on paper, is not a guarantee. When your neighbor is Syria, and Syria is actively using chemical weapons against its own population, you don't wait for the OPCW to file a report. You issue masks to your civilians.
Let me connect the two halves of this. The prompt asks about the distinction between chemical weapons and the nuclear threat, and about the non-proliferation architecture. The Chemical Weapons Treaty exists and actually works, mostly for compliance states. But the enforcement gap means that in the Middle East, the practical reality is that chemical weapons are a live threat, in a way that nuclear weapons, for all the anxiety about Iran, have not yet become.
And it's worth being precise about what chemical weapons actually are, because the category is broader than most people realize. The CWC defines chemical weapons as toxic chemicals and their precursors, plus munitions and devices designed to deliver them. That includes nerve agents like sarin and VX, blister agents like sulfur mustard, choking agents like chlorine and phosgene, blood agents like hydrogen cyanide, and riot control agents when used as a method of warfare.
Riot control agents. You mean tear gas?
Tear gas is explicitly banned as a method of warfare under the CWC. Law enforcement use is permitted, which is a whole other debate, but if you're in an armed conflict and you use tear gas to flush people out of a building before attacking, that's a chemical weapons violation. It seems mild compared to sarin, but the treaty draws a bright line.
Which raises the question the prompt is really getting at. How many states actually have these things? Not the ones that signed the treaty and destroyed their stocks, but the ones that either never joined, or joined and lied, or are actively pursuing them.
The honest answer is, we don't fully know, which is itself part of the problem. But we can be specific about what's known. Four states have never signed the CWC, Israel, Egypt, North Korea, and South Sudan. Israel has signed but not ratified, which is a distinct status. Let me come back to Israel because it's complicated. Egypt and North Korea are the most significant non-parties. North Korea is widely assessed to have a large chemical weapons program, possibly the third largest in the world, with estimates ranging from 2,500 to 5,000 metric tons of agents, including sarin, VX, and sulfur mustard.
North Korea's nuclear program gets all the attention.
The nuclear program dominates the news, the sanctions discussions, the symmetry. Meanwhile, North Korea's chemical arsenal, which could kill enormous numbers of people in a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, gets comparatively little attention. It's the neglected threat.
The loudest sibling gets all the parental attention.
Then there's Russia. Russia is a party to the CWC and completed its declared destruction, but in recent years we've seen chemical weapons reemerge as a tool of Russian state policy. The Novichok poisoning of Sergei Skripal in Salisbury in 2018, the poisoning of Alexei Navalny in 2020, both using Novichok nerve agents developed in the Soviet Union and never declared. The OPCW has confirmed these were chemical weapons attacks. Russia denies everything, but the pattern is clear. A state party to the treaty using chemical weapons for targeted assassinations on foreign soil.
That's not a loophole. That's just open defiance.
And it erodes the norm. Every time a state uses chemical weapons without meaningful consequence, the norm weakens. Syria used them repeatedly. Russia used them. The international response has been sanctions, condemnations, OPCW reports. But no one has been held individually accountable in a way that changes the calculus.
What about Iran? The prompt specifically mentions the Iran question.
Iran is a party to the CWC and has declared no chemical weapons stockpile. But Iran also suffered massively from chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. Saddam Hussein used sulfur mustard and nerve agents extensively against Iranian troops and civilians, with estimates of over 100,000 Iranian casualties. So Iran has direct, traumatic experience with chemical warfare.
Which you'd think would make them the strongest advocates for the treaty regime.
Publicly, they are. But U.S. intelligence assessments have periodically raised concerns about Iran maintaining a dual-use chemical industry that could be converted to weapons production. The capabilities exist. The question is intent. And this is where the non-proliferation challenge gets really difficult. The precursors for chemical weapons are also used in legitimate industrial processes. You can't ban thioglycol, it's used in inks and plastics. You can't ban triethanolamine, it's in cosmetics. The dual-use problem is even more acute for chemical weapons than for nuclear.
You can't solve it by controlling the supply chain the way you can with enriched uranium.
A centrifuge cascade is hard to hide and has essentially no civilian application. A chemical reactor making organophosphates could be making pesticides. The distinction is intent and purity, not the basic infrastructure.
Which brings us to Israel. You said Israel signed but didn't ratify. What's the actual status?
Israel signed the CWC in 1993, but has never ratified it. That means Israel is not legally bound by the treaty, though as a signatory, it's expected not to act against the treaty's object and purpose. Israel's stated position is that it supports the convention in principle, but won't ratify until there's a comprehensive peace in the region and all its neighbors join and comply. That's the official line. The practical reality is that Israel is widely believed to maintain an offensive chemical weapons capability, though the exact nature and scale is classified.
The gas masks in every apartment are partly a hedge against the neighborhood not complying.
That's the logic. Israel faces threats from non-state actors as well. Hamas has used crude chemical agents in rocket warheads. Hezbollah has been accused of seeking chemical capabilities. The civil defense approach, the masks, the safe rooms, the home front command instructions, all of that is built on the assumption that treaties are paper and deterrence requires preparation.
If I'm tracking this correctly, the global chemical weapons landscape is one highly successful treaty with near-universal membership, a Nobel Prize-winning verification organization, 98% of declared stockpiles destroyed, and simultaneously chemical weapons have been used in active conflicts, for assassinations, and by states that are parties to the treaty, with essentially no enforcement consequences. That's not a contradiction. That's a paradox.
It's a paradox that reflects the difference between the normative framework and the power framework. The normative framework says, chemical weapons are beyond the pale. The power framework says, if you have a patron on the Security Council, you can use them anyway.
The cynic's version of international law.
Yet I'm not entirely cynical about the CWC, because the norm has held in important ways. Most states have destroyed their weapons and aren't seeking new ones. The stigma is real. When Syria used chemical weapons, it denied it. When Russia used Novichok, it denied it. Nobody stands up and says, yes, we use chemical weapons and we're proud of it. Even the violators feel compelled to lie. That tells you the norm has force even if it's not absolute.
The lie is the tribute. Vice pays to virtue.
But for the person wondering whether to keep their expired gas mask, the norm is cold comfort.
Let me ask you a technical question then. If someone is worried about a chemical attack, not a nuclear one, not a dirty bomb, but specifically nerve agents or blister agents, what should they actually be looking for in a mask? Because the CBRN label, as you've explained, is a starting point, not an answer.
The key specification you want is a mask rated for chemical warfare agents, and the specific certification varies by country. In the US, you're looking for CBRN approval from NIOSH, but more importantly, you want to know what the canister is rated for. A proper chemical warfare filter uses ASCM-TDA carbon, which is activated charcoal impregnated with metals and organic compounds that chemically neutralize agents rather than just physically trapping them. Copper, silver, zinc, molybdenum, plus triethylene etamine. That's the ASCM part. The TDA is the triethylene etamine, which specifically targets cyanogen chloride and other blood agents.
It's not just a fancy particulate filter.
Not at all. A particulate filter stops aerosols and dust. A chemical warfare filter chemically reacts with the agent to neutralize it. Sarin passing through an ASZM TETA filter doesn't just get trapped, it gets hydrolyzed, broken down into less toxic compounds. That's the difference between filtering and defeating.
The Israeli civilian masks, they use this kind of filtration?
The later models did. The M15 and the later civilian models used activated charcoal filters with impregnated carbon. They were designed specifically for the Syrian threat matrix. The limitation was always fit and seal. A mask is only as good as the seal against your face. Facial hair, glasses, the wrong size, all of that compromises protection. The Israeli distribution system included fitting stations where they'd measure your face and issue the correct size. That's the kind of detail that actually determines whether the mask saves your life or just gives you a false sense of security.
Which feels like a metaphor for the whole topic. The treaty is the mask, the verification system is the seal, the enforcement mechanism is the fit, and right now, the seal is broken in some very important places.
That's good. I'm gonna let that sit there.
Let me bring it back to the prompt's core question about nuclear versus chemical. If Iran were to use a nuclear weapon on Israel, we're talking about blast, thermal radiation, prompt radiation, and fallout. A mask does nothing for the blast and the heat. For fallout, you need particulate filtration, which is the easier part of the CBRN equation. The radioactive particles are particles. You filter them mechanically. The chemical threat is actually more demanding in some ways because you need that reactive chemistry.
The timescales are completely different. A nuclear detonation is an instantaneous event with lingering contamination. A chemical attack is a persistent cloud that you need to survive until it disperses or you evacuate. The mask has to work continuously for hours, in some scenarios, while you shelter in place. The Israeli civil defense instructions for a chemical attack are, seal the room, put on the mask, wait for instructions. The safe room concept, the Mamad, is designed with chemical filtration as a primary requirement. Overpressure systems to keep contaminated air out.
The Israeli safe room is basically a collective mask.
That's exactly what it is, and it's a recognition that individual protection is the last line of defense, not the first. The hierarchy is deterrence, prevention, detection, collective protection, individual protection. The mask is step 5.
The treaty is step 1.
The treaty is step 1, which is why the enforcement question matters so much. If step 1 fails, you're relying on steps 4 and 5, which is a terrible place to be.
What would actual enforcement look like if we're serious about chemical weapons non-proliferation beyond the paper treaty?
The OPCW has actually evolved in interesting ways. In 2018, it was given a new mandate to identify perpetrators of chemical attacks, not just confirm that attacks occurred. The Investigation and Identification Team, the IIT, was created specifically because Russia blocked the UN mechanism. So the OPCW created its own attribution capability. It's a workaround, but it's real. The IIT has named the Syrian Air Force, has named specific units. That's new. That's the treaty regime adapting to enforcement failure.
Naming and shaming with a Nobel Prize behind it.
Syria, CWC member but repeatedly violated. Iran, CWC member with undeclared capabilities. Egypt, signed but not ratified, suspected program. Israel, signed but not ratified, suspected program. And then there are non-state actors, ISIS produced and used mustard gas. Hezbollah has been accused of using chemical agents in Syria, though that's harder to verify. There was a landmark trial in Germany, the Koblenz trial, that convicted a Syrian colonel for crimes against humanity, including chemical weapons use. That conviction was built partly on OPCW evidence.
The enforcement isn't coming from the Security Council. It's coming from national courts picking up the slack.
But chemical weapons are easier to produce, harder to detect, and have actually been used in conflict multiple times since the CWC entered into force. Nuclear weapons haven't been used in war since 1945.
The justice system is a long-tailed deterrent.
Meanwhile, the threat evolves. The Novichok attacks showed that we're dealing with novel agents that weren't on anyone's list when the CWC was negotiated. That's the really worrying trend. Every time a chemical weapon is used without meaningful consequences, the norm weakens a little more. Syria used sarin in 2013, and the world blinked.
The general prohibition covers new agents, though, doesn't it? The treaty doesn't just ban a list, it bans the category.
The cost-benefit calculation for using chemical weapons is shifting, and not in a good direction. If it's toxic and you intend to use it as a weapon, it's prohibited, full stop.
Which is elegant legal drafting, but it still depends on someone enforcing it.
But the threat they were meant to address hasn't gone away. If anything, it's diversified and become more complex. The Israeli Home Front Command has been working on a new distribution program, but it's been slow and underfunded.
What's the state of play right now? Mid-2026. What are the active chemical weapons concerns?
The Syria file remains open and ugly. The OPCW continues to press Syria on its incomplete declaration. The Assad regime continues to obstruct. The expired gas mask problem is a perfect microcosm of Israeli civil defense. The masks are government property, so you can't throw them away, but the government hasn't provided a clue mechanism for returning or replacing them.
The people who use them are still in power.
Still in power, still unaccountable. That's the hardest part of this. The chemical weapons attacks in Syria weren't carried out by rogue elements. They were directed by the highest levels of the regime. The chain of command has been documented. Every Israeli household has one. It's like a national membership card you didn't ask for and can't cancel. The OPCW has condemned Russia, but Russia remains a member of the organization, participates in decision-making, and continues to block action.
The Israeli masks were designed for chemical agents like sarin and VX, which were the main fear during the Gulf War, and remain a concern given Iran's capabilities.
Then there's the North Korea question, which is entirely outside the treaty framework since they never joined. North Korea's chemical arsenal is integrated into its broader asymmetric warfare doctrine. Artillery shells, ballistic missile warheads, covert delivery. The threat to South Korea and Japan is significant, and it's almost never discussed in the same breath as the nuclear program.
Because the nuclear program is the shiny object.
It's also more existentially threatening. A nuclear weapon can destroy a city in seconds. Chemical weapons are horrific, but they don't have the same instantaneous mass lethality. So the prioritization makes some sense. But the neglect is still dangerous.
Let me ask a question that might sound naive. Given everything you've just described, the enforcement failures, the repeated use, the lack of accountability, is the Chemical Weapons Convention actually working? Or is it just a beautiful piece of paper?
I think the answer is, it's working for the 90%+ of the world that was never going to use chemical weapons anyway. The treaty has successfully stigmatized these weapons, has created a verification architecture, has destroyed declared stockpiles. For the states that were determined to cheat, it hasn't stopped them. But it has made their cheating more difficult, more detectable, and more costly. Syria had to lie. Russia had to deny. The alternative is a world where chemical weapons are normalized, where states openly maintain them, openly threaten to use them, openly use them. That world is worse.
The treaty is a ratchet, not a lock.
A ratchet that slips sometimes, but still sets a direction.
If I'm an Israeli with an expired gas mask in my closet, listening to this, what's the takeaway?
The takeaway is that the mask was issued for a specific threat that hasn't gone away. Syria's chemical weapons capability is degraded, but not eliminated. Hezbollah's aspirations are unclear but concerning. The civil defense logic that produced the mask distribution is still valid, even if the specific mask in your closet is past its technical lifespan. The Homefront Command has a replacement program, and the current guidance is to return expired masks and get new ones.
The bureaucracy of survival.
It's very Israeli, honestly. Here is your existential threat. Please fill out Form 17B, Q at Station 4.
If you're not Israeli, if you're someone listening in another country who's trying to think seriously about chemical weapons preparedness,
I'd say, first, understand that the threat is real, but specific. If you live in a region where chemical weapons use is plausible, a properly fitted mask with ASCM TET-A filtration is worth having. If you don't, your money is probably better spent on a good smoke detector and a fire extinguisher. The most likely chemical threat to most people is an industrial accident, not a military attack. A basic escape hood rated for industrial chemicals covers the realistic scenario.
The boring answer that saves more lives.
Preparedness is mostly boring. That's why people prefer the exciting scenarios.
The prepper fantasy is the nuclear winter survivalist, not the guy who checked his smoke alarm batteries.
The chemical weapons non-proliferation fantasy is the perfect treaty that eliminates all weapons forever. The reality is the CWC, which is imperfect, incomplete, and still worth defending.
To pull this together, chemical weapons are a distinct category from nuclear and radiological threats, requiring different protection, different thinking, and a different treaty regime. That regime, the Chemical Weapons Convention, has been remarkably successful at destroying declared stockpiles and establishing a global norm. It has also failed, repeatedly and publicly, at stopping determined violators. The Israeli gas mask distribution was a practical response to that enforcement gap. The masks in the closets are a physical reminder that treaties are necessary but not sufficient.
The specific technical distinction that prompted this whole discussion, CBRN versus chemical-only protection, matters because the threat determines the tool. A CBRN mask is a compromise design trying to cover everything. A purpose-built chemical warfare mask is optimized for the threat that Israel actually faced. The difference isn't academic. It's the difference between a filter that traps particles and a filter that chemically destroys nerve agents.
Which is the kind of detail you only learn when you're forced to take the threat seriously.
Or when you have a brother who won't stop reading OPCW technical reports.
There are worse hobbies.
I could be into model trains.
The model train community just caught a stray. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, a naturalist exploring the Labrador coast described a deep-sea hydrothermal vent worm that was subsequently believed extinct for over a century and a half until a remotely operated vehicle rediscovered it in 2023, clinging to a vent chimney at a depth of nearly 2 miles. Scientists now believe the worm's lineage survived multiple mass extinction events by retreating to these deep ocean refugia, making it one of the oldest continuous animal lineages on Earth.
A worm that outlasted the dinosaurs by hiding in a deep-sea sauna.
2 miles down. That's commitment to the bit.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this operation running. If you enjoyed the episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more than you know. We're at myweirdprompts.com if you want to send us your own weird question. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.